This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
I mean, you can hear me.
Yes. Yes, I can hear you. I'll edit this out. I'm just hoping that this is recorded somewhere.
While we're getting ready, tell me about what you've been doing. I already know what I do.
Yeah. Well,
you're a busy guy.
Yes, I am. But it's been more my personal life that has been dominating things. I haven't been, you know, really that productive lately.
I get 38 articles on economic history from you every week.
Well, yes, but that's
good, by the way.
Yes, but it's like riding a bicycle in a way, you know.
Okay, now we're in business. Okay, let me give it three seconds for a pause. I'm gonna edit this out. Hello and welcome to New Books Network in History. This is Bernardo Batis Lasso, and today we have the pleasure of having James W. Cortada as our guest, talking about his latest book, which is IBM, The Rise and Fall and Reinvention of a Global Icon. Jim, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Jim, you have been able to combine your work as a historian with your work at IBM. So would you please tell the audience a little bit about that? And how you progressed and how you became and moved from one area to the other. Well, you never left one, really.
Yes, when I joined IBM in 1974, I had a PhD in European history. And I made a decision that I would not give up my love of history after joining IBM, and that I would continue to do research and writing on history, like a hobby. Some people paint, some people are in sports. I decided I would do history. So, but at the same time, I followed the advice that my father gave me, which was commit myself completely to the development of my business career at IBM. Right. Do not compromise that. Buy into the culture, embrace its values, embrace the aspirations of people who want to be successful in the company. And I did that. And I spent 38 years at IBM, most of it in sales and sales management and executive management and in consulting. I had a wonderful career at IBM, the way an IBM employee would understand it. But at the same time, I had this hobby. About 4 years into IBM, around 1978, I realized that nobody was writing on the history of computing. I mean, there was one or two scholarly books a year, and they were on technology. And about every 3 or 4 years, somebody would, some engineer would attempt to write some history. But I was a professionally trained historian, and I kept writing on European history. And I said, you know, there's no competition here. I should begin to write on the history of computing and its industry. So I began to gather materials. I began to study things. And then I discovered that IBM had a wonderful archive, that there was another archive at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, another one at the University of Minnesota, and the National Archives in Washington, D.C. And I said, wow, nobody's here, no competition. So I began to collect materials on the history of the industry and became very familiar with IBM's archives. And every time I was in the New York area where the archives were at the time, I would make time to spend, you know, 2 or 3 hours there, pick up materials and collect. And so over the years that accumulated, I wrote a number of history books on the industry. I also wrote some management books because I discovered that business management writers were terrible, but people who are trained in history and the humanities are taught to write. So I had less competition there for quality. So I wrote on those subjects, and I just kept doing this much like playing tennis. And you know, if you do it for 40 years, you accumulate publications.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's what happened. It's very simple.
Interesting. And how then, how did you approach or make an acquaintance of Alfred Chandler? Because you work with him, and I don't know to what extent you kind of alerted him to the computer industry, because there is a not a change, but you know, it's one of the things that kind of appears at the late stages of his writing, and one of the first steps that he does there, he does that with you, at least.
Yeah. So what happened was, in 1978, this is an important date, I came across his book, The Visible Hand. I did not know Al Chandler. I did not know that he had won the Pulitzer Prize for that book. I did not know that he was the god of all business historians. All I knew is that this guy was up at Harvard and had written what I thought was a really good business management book. Remember, this is when I was just beginning to study business history. Up to this point, I knew about Franco, I knew about the UN and everything else, but not about. So he was just another guy. And I read his book and I really liked it, but I had some questions. I said, let me give him a call and see if he'll answer my questions. So I called his office and he was in. I introduced myself. He probably thought, well, who is this guy? And got to talking. He was, and then he started asking me questions. So he found out I had a PhD in history, that I was a sales manager at IBM, so that's, you know, contradictory right there. That I had published a bunch of stuff, and that I was interested in business history, and I asked, obviously, questions that were intriguing to him. Well, that started a relationship. One thing led to another, and at the end of the 1990s, I had decided, by this point, I had written a number of books on business history, and I approached them and said, you know, a big open question here is, we don't understand how information is flowing through American history, particularly in business. And I'd like to write a book on it, but I don't know enough to do it. Why don't you and I collaborate in getting all the experts at that time to contribute chapters? He said, well, you can do that. I said, no, you don't understand. They don't know me. But if you invite them to participate, they will. And I'll do all the grunt work. Mm-hmm. All the, you know, back office work and everything else. So he agreed to that. He loved the topic. It took me 15 minutes only to sell it to Oxford University Press. It was my publisher at the time. Only 15 minutes. And so the book was a success. And then I went to him for advice on my next books. And he and I started having conversations about computers and the computer industry and how it affected all of American management and structures and so on. So I think I like to think that I changed him a little bit, but he also helped me enormously right up to the time that he died in the early 2000s.
Yep.
Now, what was really funny was when I published my first really big, important book on the history of computing, which was Before the Computer, with Princeton University Press. Up to that point, he had never endorsed anybody else's book. My editor sent the page proofs over to him to look at, and he said he'd be delighted to endorse the book. When he endorsed the book, on the back of the jacket, says, this is a good book, read it, everybody, that kind of thing. Everybody looked around and said, who is Cortada?
Yeah.
Chandler won't endorse my book, but he'll endorse Cortada's. Who's this guy? I started getting phone calls. So he made me.
Yeah.
As they say, in the mafia, he made me.
Yeah.
So that's Al Chandler. I love the man.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, that was a super anecdote. Thank you very much. Because it always intrigued me how that worked. But coming back to the book, I mean, obviously as you have advanced, it was something that you never really left. And clearly your list of publications made a record of that. But how was it that you came to the idea of writing a book on IBM, knowing that that would probably close the doors for you with other IBMers until they retired?
I knew probably 25 years ago that someday I would probably write a history of IBM. I read everything that came out on IBM, including all those wonderful technology histories by Emerson Pugh. We became friends over the years. And in 1995, he published his history of IBM. I knew Bob Sobel, who's a professional historian. He had published a history of IBM in 1981. And as the years went by, I knew that IBM needed a fresh history. And it's just a question, because time passes, right? Also, over the years, I had read a great deal of business history. And very few people had touched IBM who were professional historians. So there were a lot of issues that were not being discussed, by technology historians and so on about IBM. And as I stayed at IBM, I realized that nobody understood the company well enough who was outside of it because of its strong culture. They were missing it. They got close, but they didn't quite get it right, So I knew I was going to eventually write a history of the company. It was just inevitable. And people would start asking me, Cortada, when are you going to write your history? I said, I can't write it while I'm an employee. That's inappropriate. No bueno, as they say, right? So I began to collect materials with the permission of the archivist. Mm-hmm. So I went through three archivists over the years, gathering materials, some of which I used in other books, and some of which I set aside for someday writing this book. And I kept buying whatever came out, and if I saw newspaper articles or magazine articles, I collected. So I built quite a file. So then I retired at the end of 2012. And working at IBM is very pressure filled. So I needed about a year to sort of get some distance. After you were a university student, that first year afterwards, you said, wow, what just happened to me, right? And right. Well, I just went through that. I felt like I had just graduated from IBM University. And it taught me a great deal about life and business and history. But after a year, I began to think, maybe now is the time to start work on such a book. So I began to, do the usual things of building the outlines, figuring out what I was missing, having conversations with people. And then I said, okay, I am now going to write this book. And I decided the audience would be academic on the one hand, but all my IBM colleagues on the other.
Right.
So the writing style had to be more popular, trade-like, but it had to have the rigor, academic rigor. And IBM lawyers had taught me long time ago, never write anything that you cannot prove in a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
Or bring your evidence. So that was my standard for the scholarship, was court of law, you know, legal standards, not academic standards, which are, the legal standards are actually more rigorous.
Yeah.
And even when I finished writing it, I took the last two chapters, which dealt with contemporary IBM, and I showed it to a business lawyer who was not in IBM, but just outside of IBM. And I said, can IBM sue me for this?
Yeah.
Take me to jail. And he came back and said, nope, you're rock solid. Yeah, yeah. All your sources are publicly available. You just pulled it all together. So what I did was I wrote a history that told the normal story that you would in a business history book about governance, products, markets, lots of interesting details about senior executives, many of whom I had met over the years. So I could describe their personalities, you know, that sort of thing that you can't get out of the New York Times, right?
Yeah.
And I knew what to emphasize and what not to emphasize over the years. And I said it within the context of how business historians write today. I also spent more time describing IBM's culture, because everybody who has ever worked at IBM will tell you two things. The people were fantastic, and the culture just made the business more successful than unsuccessful over the course of 130 years. So it's very important that I get those two pieces woven in, and only I as an IBM employee understood how to explain that at the time. None of the prior literature did that. The one thing I decided not to do was to spend too much time on all the technological innovations, because I thought Emerson Pugh had done that, and out of respect for him, that's it. We'll leave. Yeah,
that's, but nevertheless, it's well, as you've said, that is one of the core issues of, or core ideas in the book, which is how to portray this organizational culture that it's growing and it's evolving, and it has to, as you say in the title, to withstand not only success but an apparent, you know, almost collapse.
And then as they say in Spanish, a golpe.
Sí. And having to resuscitate, not resuscitate, because it didn't totally collapse, but being able to survive this huge process of change. No?
Yeah. Very difficult to do. It's not easy. Because remember, after World War II, the company was formed in the 1880s. But after World War II, it always had over 100,000 employees. And by the end of the 1980s, it had 400,000 employees. And it was in over 150 countries. Very complicated organization.
Yes, and a very complicated, sorry to jump in here.
Yeah.
Also a very complicated book to write, because just for the sake of being transparent, well, not transparent, but clear, you know, it has, it's a very big book. It's a 700 pages book.
I'm sorry.
No,
my apologies. Big company.
Exactly. It's a big company. And then it's a very long period of time from 1880 until 2012. And you split this into four big sections, which is the origins, the market dominance between 1945 and 85, the crisis between 85 and 94, and then the renewal between 95 and 2012. And that is certainly, from a business history perspective, or something that should appeal to colleagues in organizational studies is how you are able to interweave all of these moving parts and then tell this story of the organizational culture and how it's being created, evolving, and how it's withstanding that. But at the same time, you also bring, I think, the view from the inside and a critique that I've found in other with other former IBMers, which is this desperation with senior management or senior managers in the 1980s and kind of, you know, when the companies, you know, this going into crisis and people having different views as to what should be the way forward, no?
Yeah. It's a company that usually allowed a great deal of debate.
Mm-hmm.
About what to do. And it also is a company that has always had specific ways of communicating different ideas in a formal manner, okay? And it's always had that right from the beginning. So that was very helpful. The company also, I know this is going to sound strange to your listeners, but I don't think I ever met a stupid IBMer. IBM employee. Now, years later, I found out why. It's the selection process. You begin, everybody takes an intelligence test. Yeah, they take an intelligence test. And if it says you're stupid, the interviews don't go on, you know? So you bring in all these very smart people, you train them extensively for their entire careers on management, on organizational structures, on the technology, on how to communicate, how to think, you know, all these things repeatedly. And you give them freedom to carry out their responsibilities. Now, what that does is it allows a very intelligent person to articulate their points of view. You hold them accountable for their successes. And of course, you have debates, you know, and like debates, you yell at each other and you get mad and you have differences of points of view and so on. But the ideas surface. Once an idea has been agreed upon, then implementation of it goes very quick in any period. Because part of all the debates about what to do, even in the periods of crisis, also involve things like, well, if I were going to run this company, here are the five things I would do, and here are the four people I would have working on. So there was a plan, always a plan, you know? So once an idea was accepted, the plan that came with it was also accepted. And then people were very disciplined, and they immediately implemented it in general, right? I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's important to get the whole idea together. And that is a way to cause problems on the one hand, but on the other hand, once you have a solution for getting out of a problem, you've got a path.
But isn't it, again, and I might be stereotyping, isn't it that very much the way that engineers work?
Yes.
You know, it's
very scientific.
Yes.
Very scientific, very engineering.
Very
political too. But here's the thing that I thought made IBM very lucky. IBM before 1911 was three or four, depending on how you want to measure it, little companies that didn't collaborate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they were okay. You know, it was nothing exciting. The guy who was running it put it together mainly to sell stock. But he realized there was potential here for data processing, which is what they call it in those days. So he needed a professional manager. So he hired a fellow by the name of Thomas Watson, who at the time was a 42-year-old, highly successful senior executive who had worked at NCR, which was another major competitor. So he brought this man in. Now, the thing about it is that he grew up in the IBM of the 19th century, that is NCR, well-run company by one of the best senior executives in the United States. and a very honest man and straightforward. And so he wasn't like Rockefeller or some of these other people. So this Watson was trained by this guy. So he came to work in 1914 at IBM. It wasn't even called IBM at the time. It's called CTR.
Yeah.
And when he came in at the age of 42, think about a man of 42 years old, already has a business philosophy, has experience in sales, knows what he likes and doesn't like about measurements, knows the kind of people he likes to have around him. In other words, he brought NCR's mature culture, which had been developed over a 30, 40 year period in one of the best run companies in the United States. He brought it into what became IBM and immediately implemented it, right down to the same language, the same procedures and everything else. Then he ran the company for 45 years. So over the 45 year period, what he brought into the company was put into cement, because you now had a third, when he died in 1956, you had a third generation that knew only his way to do things. And at the time, he was considered perhaps the number one executive in the United States for effectiveness, morality, all those things. It's that 45 years of constancy of purpose, right? To use a phrase that his friend Peter Drucker used. All right. His son takes over the business in 1956. He completely embraces his father's way of doing business because he too grew up in the company. And he stayed until 1971. And in his period of time, he was able to make the company very, very large all over the world, and to implement the original philosophy, the original way of doing things. And so you get this IBM culture, you get this engineering view also, I like your phrase, but also it's a sales culture in that every problem can be solved. Opportunity is everywhere. Let's go get it. You know, that kind of a mindset. And so that sustained the company, and it has really to a greater than lesser extent to the present. A lot of superficial things on the outside that people complain about disappeared, you know, and the one major thing that disappeared certainly by the end of the century was that Watson Sr. never liked to fire people. He wanted to hire you to come in and stay for life. Mm-hmm. But you have to give your body and soul to the company in exchange. You know, it's like you become a priest. You're a priest 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the rest of your life. It's that kind of, but you'll never go hungry, you know, and you'll be properly paid. Well, that piece of the culture went away at the end of the 20th century, as it did for many other corporations. And that created all kinds of changes at IBM. But there was enough of this core about ideas, about smart people, about how to implement things that has continued to the present. Even with the introduction of many tens of thousands of new employees that were professionally hired into the company.
And in that sense, we're moving from the organizational culture, which is a very, you know, as I said, it's one of the main things that stand out. What do you think that the general public will find interesting in reading the book or reading parts of the book?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned parts, because I designed the book so that you did not have to read the whole thing. In fact, in the preface, I tell you, if you're an employee, here's what you ought to read right now, and then go back and read the rest. If you are a retired employee or retired customer of IBM, read these chapters first, then read the rest. And if you're a historian, I'm sorry, you have to start on page one, right? Yeah. So the way to answer your question is, how did retired IBM employees read the book and react? That may be the honest test that I have. I've heard now from well over 200 retired IBM employees, some of them have been retired for 30 years, you know, in their 90s, you know. What they liked was the, what they call, it's an easy read. It was not academic language. I wrote it almost the way I'm talking to you now, not with a lot of fancy vocabulary. And when I introduce a business term, I defined it as it was known at that time. So within a historical perspective. And I made sure that I didn't spend too much time in extreme detail. I spent more time giving you a quick overview of something and then explaining why that was. And then toward the end of the book, the implications for other companies and other employees. Now I'm writing a sequel, right, which is more on the culture of the company. That will be more for the public. Anybody who isn't interested in computer technology and so on, because I find that rather boring. And the reason why is because when I was a salesman, I had to explain to non-technical management why they should spend $1 million on an IBM computer. And going in and telling them feeds and speeds and what DASD does and CPUs and all that, they don't want to hear that. They want to know, how many answers am I going to get out of this machine every month?
Right. You know?
So that taught me how to write this book.
Yeah.
You know, it's as the old expression goes, my mother would like it. You know, it's somebody who knows nothing about computers, somebody who doesn't know how large corporations run. I write it for them. And in fact, sales of the book have been to that audience more than to scholars. You know, all the usual libraries bought copies and so on. But it's one of the arguments I make in the book is that IBM was an example of a large international company. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was unique. Yes, it was very successful. But if you read the history of IBM, you get to understand Kodak, Philips, you know, all these great companies, because they were all part of a common culture and had common issues, such as how do you run your company in 150 countries where everybody speaks a different language? Well, you make sure they all also understand English, or in Philips, they want you to understand Dutch, you know. So you've got common issues that they all face. So when you read the book, you get exposed to Citicorp and Philips and all these other companies in a similar way. And I wanted that also for the historians who, if they go write a good history of General Motors — we don't have a good history of General Motors — they would know what issues to discuss. And if they wrote it in a friendly style, there are hundreds of thousands of retired General Motors employees who run out and buy it. Or should buy it,
yes. You've talked about collecting material throughout a very long period of time, making use of that material, making use of your own insights. Were you tempted at some point of using, or, you know, interviews or oral histories, talking to other people, to other former employees, and not only passing them chapters, but actually systematically collecting their views and adding to your voice?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did, even while I was at IBM. Mm-hmm. On occasion, I would talk to people who I thought were pivotal, and I would tell them why. I want to make a record of this in case I should ever write a history of IBM. And I would also ask their permission at that time. And this turned out to be important. I didn't do a lot of these. I think while I was at IBM, I may have talked to this way, maybe to 8 or 10 people who I knew would be important to me later on if I wanted to use the material. I'm thinking, for example, of a gentleman who worked for Watson Senior as his executive assistant late in Watson Sr.'s career in the 1950s, who I met in the 1980s. He had been retired for many years. Very old school IBM, you know, a thin man with white hair, dark blue suit, starch white shirt. I mean, this is the way he was dressed when he was retired.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about IBM culture.
Yeah.
And we spent, over the course of 2-3 days, maybe 6 hours, talking about what IBM was like. And he had joined IBM in the 1930s.
Right.
So he exposed me to IBM in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And then I think he retired around 1960 or something. So there were a number of these individuals. And then, of course, after I retired, I talked to some other people. However, even in the years that I was at IBM, I sometimes would be in meetings where something historically important took place. Mm-hmm. And I would write notes of those meetings, as was my habit in any meeting. I took notes, much like a university student with those little spiral binders, you know. And I have all those from 1974 to the present. I use them at work as work. You know, so if you call me up and say, "Hey, Jim, what did we agree to last Wednesday?" And I open up my little notebook and I said, "We agreed to three things." He said, "Oh, yeah, I forgot the third one. Thank you." But if it was historical, historically significant, I would draw a little star. And that might only happen once a year, you know. But I would know that if I ever were to write a history of IBM, I might want to go to that notebook, that page, and I bent the page over so I didn't have to, you know, keep turning all the pages. And then, of course, I interviewed some people formally after I left IBM.
Right.
I don't know whether I answered your question, but that's how I did it.
It is. No, it is. It does, and it shows in the story that you tell. And I was just going to comment that, having benefited from some of the documents and collections that you have donated to the Charles Babbage Institute, I know that you're super organized, and that will be a resource for future scholars who want to look into this if you do donate them as
actually,
well.
My wife said I had to get rid of it all. It was rubbish. Well, thank you for the compliment. Now I should add one other thing, and that is, I followed, after I left IBM, I followed some guidelines that we had always followed in IBM with regard to information. Let me explain. I was never going to reveal anything that was marked IBM confidential. Mm-hmm. I was never going to reveal anything that would immediately help a competitor. So I know things that are going on in IBM today, I won't tell people about it until that competitor's gone and dead and whatever. And I never exposed any information that belonged to a customer of IBM. Sure. And even in this book, you know, I followed those three rules. Those are three rules we all live by at IBM with respect to sharing of information, especially outside of the enterprise. And I thought those were very good rules to go by, and it did not hurt the book at all.
Right, really good. Thank you very much. Well, Jim Cortada, you've always told us about, or that you're working in a second volume or a second version of this for a wider audience. And I want to thank you for giving us the time today, when we look forward to reading your next book, as early as we've done this one. And just this, therefore, is left for me to thank our listeners for being with us today, and not forget to subscribe to future chapters of installments of the New Books Networking History. Jim Cortada, again, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.